Okay, as you have your Bibles with you, we're getting started this evening in the book of Esther. And what I mentioned last week is Glinda, and of course women study this somewhat frequently, and the rest of us less so. And Glinda said, well, Paul, I know it's been taking a lot of hours for you to prepare, but it just gets easier. Well, it hasn't happened so far, but then on the other hand, there's so many cool things in there. I mean, if you just kind of want to buzz through and hit the highlights, you can. But let's do a little bit of review this evening. And Esther, let me just ask this. I don't have this on the review part. Esther herself, what's her family situation? She's an orphan. Parents died. Where were the parents when she died? And this has got to be a matter of deduction. Were they in Jerusalem? What were her parents the original exiles? If she's 20 and it's been 100 years, probably not the original exile. And so that's just guesstimation. And so because Cyrus freed the Jews, they've gone back, they started rebuilding this and that. Okay, I didn't make the point here. And so anyhow, Vashti is deposed, and Esther becomes a candidate, wins favor with everybody around her, and the overseer Haggai gives her special treatment and food. And the text itself in chapter 2 and verse 14 talks about how there were 6 months of perfume and cosmetics, and so you women would hate that, being babied and pampered and laid around and not have to wash dishes for a year, and whatever you want to eat is good. I don't know if you could take that or not. Maybe willing to try, though. And then Ahasuerus has attracted her, verse 17 and 18. Mordecai learns of the plot, and the conspirators are hanged. Well, that's the background to chapter 2. Now, chapter 3, I'll say the plot is pretty simple. Some of the details are particularly interesting, and so I did extra research to see if you like that. And does anybody have a handout that's not yet filled out? Now hang tight with that, Marianne. Does anybody not have a handout that would like a handout? And so we got, Rock, would you be willing to get Marianna's handout and just make a couple, three, and that'll be great. Because what I tried to do is, as we go through, I've just cited the particular verse, so you can go down and say, all right, here's where we are. And it'll probably take a couple minutes for the machine to get warmed up, and then we'll get caught up. Ahasuerus, let's do a little preliminary work. Ahasuerus is thought that his Persian name is Xerxes. When I say the Bible, the Hebrew Bible doesn't call this king Xerxes, and the history books doesn't call Xerxes Ahasuerus, but they seem to fit the same time frame. You say, wait a minute. How many people here have the New International Version Bible that you're currently reading out of? Anybody? Okay, got one. If you've got New International Version, New International says Xerxes. Because what they've done, they've not translated the Hebrew. They said, okay, it is our considered opinion that this guy that's named Ahasuerus probably is the Xerxes of history. And the reason I say that is when I say, well, Xerxes doesn't appear in the Bible, and somebody said, it is in my Bible, well, that's why. The translators anticipated that is the correct name, probably is. So Ahasuerus promoted Haman and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. Okay, here's the, just right off the bat, in chapter 3, verse 1, I want to know, why was he promoted? While you're thinking about that, Chuck Walker. You say, does it have? It, you say, it does not. Okay, because I thought you were asking, and I said, I don't know, but that's a great question. Huh. Should be hand in hand. Here's just a little passing note on this. We talked about historians a few weeks ago, how is that in the Septuagint, he is saying, when you get to the Septuagint version, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew text, that the Septuagint version does not use Xerxes at that place. I thought you were making a statement. I don't know. Now, does somebody have an online opportunity to check the Septuagint right now? Okay, and so see in, you could go Esther chapter 1, verse 1, which you'll have in the Hebrew, it'll have Ahasuerus. And it will be interesting, now as he does that, he's checking on that for us, to see if the Septuagint version cites this king, their understanding would be Xerxes. Are historians and translators always right? And the answer is no. For instance, an interesting historian that we rely on quite a bit is Josephus. Josephus inserts in his history, really written for the Romans, that this king was Artaxerxes. But that's further out of chronological sync. The only reason I say that is a lot of what he says is right and the name is wrong. And so it's just, you say, Paul, if you were preaching a sermon and you had brand new babes and everybody else here, would you stop and deal with that? No. We got mature Christians. We got Bible eaters here. And so it's good to say, all right, here's the best evidence we have. All the way in the back, Jim Hester. Artaxerxes. That's what the Septuagint has in there? Okay, so Septuagint, maybe that's where Josephus got it, and so they put Artaxerxes, but that doesn't fit chronologically. But at least it's good to know that how historians got it, that is, do not put all your marbles on historian A. Maybe they're right, maybe they're not. They don't always get it. But at any rate, so Esther chapter 3, verse 1. Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Any idea why he's promoted? No? My goodness. Well, because there's lots of opinions. Nobody knows why he was promoted. It just, well, he did something, buttered up the king, saved him from drowning in his glass of beer, whatever happened there. And just my next part of my text doesn't fit very well there for some reason. Let me take that and see if I can. Oh, I know what I did. I used a different text, and this machine does not have that text, so it is complaining about it. So, all right, let's fix that and get this now back over here to slideshow. And so, I had a real cool text, except this particular machine doesn't have it. And so regardless of why he was promoted, he was. And here's some things about, Rocky's coming in with the handouts. And here's some things about it, and this will play a little bit later. If a handout all the way in the front and one or two off on the right side there. And so, Haman, I don't know what I thought about him. He was just a rat. But what we'll find is not only he was prosperous, but very prosperous. And so, in fact, it just said, here's Haman is recounted to them the glory of his riches. And so, he's extremely wealthy. And beside that, he had 10 sons in Esther chapter 5, verse 14, and a particularly vicious wife. For instance, in 5:14, her name is Zeresh, and all his friends, so the wife says, and his friends said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits, whatever that is, 75 feet tall, and made, and in the morning asked the king to have Mordecai hang. Now, the reason I say that, maybe he's got, you know, crook friends, but his sweet little wife is joining in. Oh, yeah, let's get a gal, get a big one. Let's hang the guy in the morning. And so I thought, wow, this is not some little dainty lady that, hi, I've come here to have a Bible study. That's not her disposition. Brother Mike McCauley. Yeah, see, our little, our Western sensibilities is really on a different plane. I don't watch news, but I had a little bit of time tonight. I thought, you know what? I'm working on my stuff. I'll just turn on whatever it was, Channel 4 or something. And here, as you guys know, some, I guess, reporter or whatever goes over somewhere to the embassy. And so in an embassy, how do you expect to be treated? Well, you think so. Well, they decapitated them. Then they dismembered them. And then they just, this is not new stuff for them. This is business as usual. It's us that gets excited. Let's just have a peace accord. Let's play nice. That's not how they play the game. It just is vicious. And so she's no different. And he's very powerful. So this brings us back to the book of Esther, and in chapter 3, and down in verse 1 and 2. After these events, Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Now, there may be a smoother way of pronouncing that ancestor's name, but for the purpose of clarity, I'll just call him the Agagite. Now, as your mental process begins to percolate, what's the only, as far as I am concerned, the only Agag we tend to remember in biblical history? Here was a guy that was, what nationality, what tribal identity did Agag have? Not a Philistine. For 900 mega millions lottery winner tonight, it was Amalekite. He was a cursed. Did Larry have that? I didn't pick that up. And so here was a people that were cursed by God. And Saul was supposed to go in and kill them, absolutely destroy, wipe them out, including Agag. Samuel comes up after the battle happens, and Saul says, I've done what the Lord wanted. And so Saul says that, and Samuel says, I'll just say, if so, then what is this? Yeah, what is this sheep and the lowing of the ox? If you've wiped out every living thing, how come I'm hearing moo, moo, meh? Oh, yeah, well, see, the people wanted to save it. Hold it. You're the king of the nation. What do you mean? You're given a command by God, and, well, you roll over. And so Agag, text says, Agag thought the fear of death was past him, so he comes up cheerful, and like Chuck says, Samuel takes out a sword and just hacks him up. Now, here's one of the things that comes up. It's one, and there's several even in chapter 3. Is this Agagite related to that Agag? Brother Jim Myers, three quarters of the way back. You say, how do you pronounce it? I chose, I was going to go on the internet, because you can find the right pronunciation of difficult things. I chose to pronounce, since the guy's name that we're familiar with is Agag. I'm purposely calling him an Agagite. probably that's not the right way to say it, but it really resonates because that ties in with that name. Now, here's the problem with that name. That people say, this Agag that we're familiar with was 500 years prior. Are you related to some people 500 years ago? Yeah, so somebody, Paul, who are they? I don't know who they are. Some horse thief back in Hungary, as far as I know. And so now here's what the commentators say. They said, this guy is so far back in history, this guy in Persia is probably not related to him. Well, what do you say about that?
I don't agree with that.
Yeah, it could. Now, if you had to debate it, well, there's...
If you look at the Jewish nation, once again, an Aramaic colony.
Yes.
There are Benjamites. From all the 12 yes. tribes, the heritage went out, yet the father was the head of that. So
yeah.
Agag, like you say, could be the father of that nation. And if you don't...
Now, I give you this so you can make a comment. Kylan Dalidge, a respected Old Testament commentary, says he probably was an Elamite. Now, when somebody says probably, what does that tell you? He doesn't know. The other commentators say, no, he's probably related to that original Agag. What does that tell you? They don't know. My sense is that he's probably related because, and there's two things that resonate in my mind. If you say, I don't think so, that's okay. It really won't change the story at all. Number one, 4 or 5 times in Esther, his genealogical reference is cited. That seems to be a big deal. And number two, his hatred of the Jews. Jim Hester, he had a hand up all the way in the back. No, Agag was a member of the Amalekite nation. And in fact, one commentary says he may be using Agag just as an individual representative of the nation. Like people, if you're a member of Church of Christ, in the olden days, say you're a Campbellite. They're only taking one preacher and applying it to everybody. And so I say that there is controversy. And I've thought about it both ways, and I thought for myself, I'll anticipate that he is related to the original Agag, which might, if that's so, it's not a big deal either way, it would suggest why such vicious, bitter attitude to the rest of the Jews. Why? What were the Jews supposed to do to his people? Yeah, absolutely slaughter them, annihilate them, exterminate them, wipe them out. Now what's he want to do to the Jews? I want to annihilate them, exterminate them, and wipe them out. Perhaps that is the historical reference. And so he's made the head over all the princes. And in verse 10 of chapter 3, the king gives him his signet ring. He's a special representative. So anyhow, very, very powerful in the kingdom. I'm going to start the text reference on the bottom of the screen. I usually do the top. But chapter 3 and down in verse 2. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate. All right, we've done this in Esther. We've done it in Ruth. When we say they were sitting at the gate or in the king's gate, who sat in the gate? It was the elders, the city officials, the representatives, the judges. This is not the homeless people that didn't have any place to go. We're going to talk about some official position when we're dealing with this. And so here all the royal officials, New International Version says, at the king's gate, knelt down and paid homage to Haman. Reading, I put it at the bottom of the screen because here's the guys kneeling down. It just seemed to be close to them. Why are those guys kneeling down to Haman? For the king had commanded this concerning him. It is a royal command. When you see him walk down the aisle, you officials bow to him. It's not stated that everybody in the nation had to do it. It kind of like I first thought of was in military, when you have a superior officer and he's walking down. Let's just take it this way. What is an enlisted man, Larry, supposed to do when he is passing an officer?
Yell.
Okay. Is the officer required to salute the enlisted man? And so there is acknowledgement and an honor exchange. Do I have to salute the captain? No, I'm not in the military. And so he's getting this honor, very rich, now very powerful. But Mordecai, the text said, would not kneel down or pay him honor. And so here we have Mordecai. You see him standing in the back. He's saying, man, I'm not doing it. But then why? And so that's one of the questions. Why wouldn't, let's take it, and it's probably several layers of answer. Why wouldn't Mordecai kneel down? The emperor, the imperial edict is said when, let's say it's Chuck Walker is the chief of state. And when he says, what you need to do is pause, do a slight bow, and show him honor. And Larry says, I'm not a dooner. Rhonda, why is Mordecai not wanting to kneel? Did Jews, let me ask you a question. Did Jews kneel to anybody? Oh, they kneeled to everybody. Yes.
He was highly favored.
Yeah.
So when he comes to the city officials know it because they're part of the palace. So when they come to the gate, this man's now getting a puffy head. He thinks everybody needs to bow to him. But the command went out to the servants and those of the household that they were to give him homage. Did it completely everybody that came around him or just those who were part of the...
Okay, so is this kind of pride? Now, what does the text say that Mordecai said, why I'm not going to bow? I'm a Jew, which tells you. But the thought is he's in the gate, and the supposition is he is one of the officials, and he's not bowing. One of the things that's interesting, and I went and I checked on, did Jews bow to anybody? They bowed to everybody. When Joseph's brothers come in, they bow to him. When they're seeing Grandpa Jacob, they're bowing to him. They bow to each other. They did that as a sign of respect. And so the question will be, it's not really answered in the text. It doesn't say, I am a Jew and I'm not bowing because of Exodus chapter 20 and verse 4. Dennis all the way in the back and then Mike McCauley in the middle. Gotcha. The reality is there's all kinds of opinions. Let's talk about some of them and you can see where you settle out on that kind of thing. That what happens is in 3:3, the royal officials at the king's gate ask Mordecai. So if the officials are asked to do it, Mordecai seems to have some kind of official responsibility. And so they're asking Mordecai, why do you disobey the king's command if the officials were supposed to do the bowing? And they did it day after day. I mean, they just didn't miss it once. And he refused to comply. And they told Haman about it. And he said, I am a Jew. Well, good. And so some commentators will say, well, because there, maybe the Persians looked at Mordecai as semi-deified, and so maybe it is on a religious basis. Let's cover one area. Abraham bowed down to the sons of Heth when he negotiated with them for Sarah's grave in Genesis 23 and verse 7. Joseph's brothers bowed down to Joseph, thinking he was an Egyptian official. Genesis 42, 6. David bowed down to Saul, 1 Samuel 24 and verse 8. Jacob and his family bowed down before Esau, Genesis chapter 33. Ahimaaz bowed before King David, 2 Samuel 18 and in verse 28. So that happened quite a bit. Some will say it's on a religious basis that maybe that reference was only due to God. Jameson, Frost, and Brown takes that position. Others would say personal, more likely as Mordecai was not willing to acknowledge the wide difference in status. So some was pride. You're not all that big a shot. You're just like the rest of us. I don't care what the king thought. But what about if it really ties in to him being in the lineage of the Amalekites? And so some have this position that it was a national attitude. I'm a Jew. And Haman, as an Amalekite, they were avowed enemies of the Jews, and Bible exposition commentary would take that position. And so Haman is described five times in this small book as an Agagite. And again, that's not the most correct pronunciation, but I do it for clarity for relationship. For instance, in 3:1, 3:10, and so forth. Haman is twice described as an enemy of all the Jews. That would make sense if he has an Amalekite background and you try to annihilate my ancestors, and so, buddy, I'm in control now. Brother Chuck, up front. You mean of extermination?
No, like when Meshach, Shadrach, Abednego were going to bow before the golden, so you've got to bow.
Yes.
And they didn't know what I'm doing.
Yes.
Mordecai was told, you've got to bow.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to do that. But the other guy you mentioned,
yeah,
that was not something that was required. That's something that they did.
Did for a matter of honor. So Mordecai didn't bow because... So he's a tough dude. Okay, two hands, Dennis, all the way in the back, or Jim, all the way in the back, and then Mike McCauley.
Just kind of makes sense to me that he was already known to probably not like Jews very well when he puts an edict out, not just to punish this one man, but to wipe out a whole nation.
We're gonna get the bundle. Mike McCauley, up in the middle.
A remnant that was continued to be righteous, the people before God.
Yes.
And showing him forth as a man that is set before another ruler, they would not bow to him because he only bowed to one man, that would be God, in humility and service. And so I think looking at his heritage of where he was and looking at coming out of the exiles and the punishment that God did to him is part of a righteous remnant that is setting forth an example for the Hebraic people of what they were supposed to stand for. Back in First Samuel 16, they denied God as their king, and where he is probably looking here as accepting God as his.
So your position would be national example. Chuck's would be he's tough and he doesn't have to do it. Others, it's maybe Jim Hester's was. here's people being deified. What we see is there's a number of possibilities. What we know is he didn't do that. And so for our standpoint is mine, I'll take it from the standpoint of that national relationship that you are a cursed people. I am a Hebrew and I'm not supposed to be bowing before one of the people that God has cursed. And in Esther 3 and verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel, so apparently, you know, with all the crowds and what, maybe he hadn't noticed it up to then, but when some of the officials said, Mordecai, Haman, you know, this guy ain't doing what's right. When he saw Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. And having learned whose Mordecai's people were, oh no, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. You're a Jew. Man, if I'd have known that. And instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes, which went from where to where? Yes, from the border of India all the way to Ethiopia. So he didn't want to just kill one guy. Man, I'm wiping out the earth from these vermin. Well, that's notable. So that's why, to my mind, I thought you can, take whatever position, because this is not a thing you could totally nail down, but it would seem reasonable that, man, he has a historic hate for the Israelites and they for him. But then that created another problem in my mind. And one, I called another preacher because I want to make sure I'm not speaking out of turn. And that's this. What do you think about genocide and ethnic cleansing? Is that right or is that wrong? Yeah, let's talk about some of those details. Again, I wouldn't bring this up on a Sunday morning with people just kind of struggling to figure out, hey, am I alive or dead? Genocide, the idea of that is a deliberate killing of a large group of people, especially those of a particular or specific ethnic group, nation, or religion. Now, ethnic cleansing can be either the extermination of such a group or the relocation of such a group, okay? These skulls that you're looking at in the graphic I have piled up on some shelves here are from Cambodia, the killing fields. And so when I talk to people about genocide, first thing we think about is the Holocaust. 6 million Jews, maybe another 3 million Poles. But how about Cambodia's Khmer Rouge? 3 million people. It wasn't all over America, but the Native Americans in California during the gold rush, in estimated population of 300,000 at the beginning of the era and 30,000 at the end. You go, wow. How about Darfur, Sudan, East Timor, Indonesia, Bosnia in Europe, Bangladesh in India, Burundi, the Hutu versus the Tutsi. Each one attacks, we're going to kill you all. And then how about the Amalekites? You say, I'm against it. Well, what about that? What about that in the Bible? They were supposed to, 1 Samuel 15, destroy them all. How about the Joshua and the Canaanites? Destroy them all. Here's something to think about. God gets to determine if and when that should happen. In Genesis 15, as you get down in verse 16, here's Abraham was told that here in the future what's going to happen, your people are going to be enslaved and it's going to be 400 years. And the reason it's going to take time because the iniquity of who? The iniquity of the Amorite, that is, here's the kind of the Palestinian nations, is not yet full. It's going to get to a spot, they'll be so rotten, so terrible, I can't stand them, and I'm going to wipe them off the earth. That happens when God determines it should happen. Genesis 12, verse 23, God's the one that raises nation and casts them down. He makes those decisions. So, genocide. I'm against it. I'm for it. It depends on what God says. But I just thought I'd introduce that because the Jews were facing that in Haman's time. And so then in Esther chapter 3 and verse 7, then it gives us a time stamp. In the 12th year of King Xerxes. Now, we've come across a time stamp several times. We did it right in the very beginning. And in Esther chapter 1, in verse 3, in the third year of his reign. Then we looked at the fifth year. Now is the 12th year of his reign. 12th year, InterVarsity Press and other sources say, is the year 474. Esther, at this point, has now been queen for 4 years. And you can cross-check the numbers by citing Esther chapter 2, verse 16. Okay. But there's an interesting thing. So it just says, all right, in the 12th year, so the Greek wars are past, Esther's queen and such is. In the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the poor, which Jameson, Foster, and Brown and others say is a Persian word for the Hebrew word or principle of Lot. And when they did that, notice this, it said they did it in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. That is, now you've determined we're going to kill all the Jews. All right, when's the next thing? Chuck, you're going to build a house. Have you started building it? Okay, here's my question. When are you going to start? When's the day? When's the month? And so you have to do that somewhere or another. And so that's what he's going to do. I want to determine, if I'm going to do it this year, let's say, when should I start? And so they cast the lot. One of the things that is felt that how you would cast a lot for the month and year is if some kind of board was perhaps stretched out in front of them, and here's the months laid out. And then you have the different days, and then you throw rocks. I put a blindfold around the guy, so he was, man, I want it to be on that one, you know, like people do in the carnival, I want it to be there. But it's interesting that nations have done that forever, finding somehow or another to interpret the omens and see, is it the auspicious time to begin a war, to buy land or whatever. They do it by sheep guts. They look at the intestines, oh, this is kind of bumpy, I don't think it's very good. One of the things, when we were in Israel, they talked about, here's Masada down in the Jordan Valley and this big mountain and was a holdout for some of the Jews. And so the Romans wanted to attack, but you got to figure out when is the right time to attack. How you know the right time to attack by a Roman is, you don't remember, if you consult the sacred chickens. I am not making this up. You can go on the internet. You got holy chickens. And you have to have a holy chicken interpreter because otherwise they just look like a chicken. But you got chickens and they decided major things there. And what they did was, they said, okay, if we want to find out should we attack or not, you get the chickens out, put them down there, and you throw some seed on the ground. But you're thinking, well, what does that tell you? Well, you got to be talented like me to know the secret things, because the sound of the seed hitting the ground may tell you something about what, you know, the pagan gods are about to tell you. Then do the chickens want to eat the grain? Well, yeah or no. Maybe they had a bad night. They all got the avian flu. It's cold. They were kept up all night by the rooster or something, and they're not eating. And so the sacred chicken watchers said, hold it, it doesn't look very good. This is a bad sign. And for instance, in the First Punic War, 249 BC, Publius Claudius Pulcher, imperial council, wanted to determine divine approval for a surprise naval attack on the Carthaginian North African city whose fleet was in harbor at Drepana, Sicily. And so they consulted the royal chickens. Here's the sacred chickens that are going to tell you, should this battle start now or not? And the holy chicken watchers said the chickens weren't eating, so it's a bad omen. And Pulcher said, since they won't eat, let them drink. And he hurled them into the sea. So he pitched the chickens overboard, and he said, we're attacking anyhow. And they were absolutely demolished, lost 95 ships, 10,000 men, you know, because he got a lot of troops on the ships and so forth. It's not just a naval attack by boat to boat. And so he was humiliated, returned to Rome in the aftermath of this disastrous attack, and tried on the charge of irreverence. You weren't listening when the chickens tell you. But the reality is, you know, we look at that as kind of humorous, but in his History of Rome, Livy wrote that no action was ever undertaken in the field or at home unless the chickens had been consulted. So who rules the roost is my question. And the great affairs of state would all be put off if the birds withheld their approval, including the Roman attack at Masada. And so I say, you want to know when to start building your house? Get some chickens, Chuck, and see if them chickens are eaten, and then you know what to do. And so here they are in the time of Esther, and they got, rather than sacred chickens, they're casting these lots. And the lot fell in the 12th month. Now notice when it starts out, they're in the 12th year, but first month. And so my little graphics here point out, all right, the 12th month of Adar would correspond about to our March. And so the 13th puts it mid-March. And annihilation, because they're in the first month somewhere or another, and it'll be the middle of the 12th, so they're 11 months away. That is, there's time. Remember, we're studying Ruth and then Esther because of the principle of providence. God builds in safeguards for his people. There is time. It isn't, okay, we're, everybody's got to kill all the Jews, you know, in the next 3 hours. And so, in verse 8, and Haman said to King Xerxes, New International Version, there's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other people, who do not obey the king's laws. Was that true in Xerxes' time? He said, well, there's not been one word of it. The only one, and only in one area, did Mordecai not bow because he was a Jew in regard to Haman. But although untrue, it generates suspicion and it sounds reasonable. See, when you read stuff on the internet and somebody says, you know, if you love God and are patriots, send this along to 20 people. I never do that. So many times I check what they say is well-meaning, but the details are inaccurate. Was a hand up in the middle, Brother Mike? What says that to you?
In verse 7, it says they were casting in before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar.
That's a good point. They may have been doing that. And every month they said, no, it's not today. It's not today. That could be. Isn't that interesting? So it's still 12 months, but okay, we thought we was going to get to do it in, you know, January. It's not January. How about February? Not February. And so that's an interesting point. Thank you. And what he's saying is, well, you got these bad folks, and it's not in the king's interest to tolerate them. He said, but if it pleases the king, a decree should be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for men who will carry out this business. This guy was rich. that one of the problems is when you try to figure out how much money in today's terms is what they're saying from back there, a lot of the commentators then put it into British pounds, and then you have inflation, all this, and so some people say, well, it was $5 million, blah, blah, blah. So one, I'll just take one. Let's just say if it was $53 million. You say, well, that seems, but I'm talking in today's buying power. The Mega Millions, which is some kind of lottery thing, I didn't even know it existed until I look up there and I hear on the screen and then on the news tonight, boy, if you're going to be a billionaire, $900 million. How much to you, if you got $900 million, is $53 million? Well, that's lunch money. That's not an awful lot. Bill Gates is worth $94 billion. 94,000 million. Well, what's 53? Man, that's chump change. Warren Buffett, he's the poor sister. He's only got 85 billion. 85,000 million dollars. And 53, why, well, man, that's parking money. Mel Gibson is worth 400 million. Tom Hanks, 470. Tom Cruise, 540. LeBron James, 600 million. Tiger Woods, $900 million. So even if, regardless of whether it's current and exact, how much silver and blah, 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 people today are pretty wealthy. And so, you know, tossing out $53 million, why, that's somewhat small change for the people that are the real movers and shakers financially. So he offers, he said, King, look, it'll cost some to get all this done. And I'll tell you what, I'm such a patriot. I've got quite a bit of money, and I'll just pay for it. Wow. Yeah, well, it's not because you're a patriot, because you're a rat. So in verse 10, the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. So I just have a picture of a signet ring so it has some kind of impression and makes a mark there. And here's a scroll with some kind of seal attached. So you put it in it. And if you're the only one that has that seal, in fact, there's a death penalty. If anybody else tries to copy that, there's not a lot going around. And so, interestingly, Ahasuerus says, keep the money. The king said. Well, that begins a controversy. What do you mean, keep the money? who keeps the money, and what exactly, when you're talking about the money, which group of money is it? For instance, one of the issues is that people say, well, what he's really talking about is the money you are going to give me. You just hang on to it and don't worry about it. The other side says, no, that's not what he's saying at all. He's saying, all right, you put your $53 million in the coffers, and everything you get by wiping out the Jews, steal it. What? They don't need it anyhow. They're dead. And so people are mixed on that. But look at Haman. Just like Satan, he's a liar and a murderer. It wasn't Jews' empire-wide causing revolts. Mordecai disobeyed one law, and it's exaggerated by Haman to say all Jews were disobeying the laws. In fact, the exiles were specifically told by Jeremiah in Jeremiah 24, 4 through 7, when you're taken into the land, settle down, raise your families, sit under your vine and your fig tree, and seek the welfare of the city where you are. But be good citizens. Make good things happen. And so when he says, the silver is yours, well, and he says, the people are yours. How much authority has he just given Haman? Total authority. Do whatever you want to do, and you're the boss. Wow. And so some people will, and the commentaries are divided on this. Some will say, the silver is yours, meaning you keep all the silver you can steal from the Jews. That's Barnes and pulpit commentators' position. Others will say, no, that's not exactly what he's saying. He said, don't worry about paying me. just you do whatever you want. And so some would say he did pay him and Hazarus is trying to give it back. Some are saying Hazarus, okay, paid a $53 million and he may make a billion in theft. Whichever it is, it certainly isn't complimentary for a Hazarus or for Haman. Tom, did you have a hand up? Okay. And then just a couple more verses and we're done for this evening. And then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries are summoned. So here's the scribes. And they wrote out the script of each promise province in the language of each people, because you got everybody from the border of India, all through Mesopotamia, Asia Minor, Palestine, down into Egypt. So you have all these different dialects, and the governors of the various provinces and the nobles of the various people. And these were written in the name of the king himself and sealed with his own. You can imagine, you get down there, some governor gets to notice, what in the world? Kill all the Jews? Keep all the stuff? Who said that? I said, it's the emperor. Are you sure? It's got his seal. They sent these things all over. There is consternation. And in verse 13, and dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old and women and little children. You don't spare anybody. Wow. On a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. We're wiping those people off the face of the earth. Here's a thing that crossed my mind you might have some interest in. The Persians had a courier system. It is said to have been established by Cyrus the Great, and like our Pony Express. How long, see, our Pony Express is part of our Western lore, and everybody knows, and isn't that cool? How long did our Pony Express last? Yeah, you're in the right in the vicinity. 18 months. Why? The telegraph, beep, 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 and you're across the nation. And so it's really part of our Western lore. But what the Persians had was they had riders and they had stables as far as one horseman would be apt to ride in a day. Then they'd have another stable, fresh horses, fresh riders, and then carry that on. I just thought that was interesting along that line. And then in verse 14, a copy of the text of the edict was issued as law to every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so they would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. All right, a day's work well done. Let's just get high. But the city of Susa was bewildered. And so national leaders make bewildering decisions. Impacts all of us. Except it's all in the hands of God. So the next big thing you're facing is, man, how am I going to handle that? What, it's going to be A or B. Romans 8:28 says, all things work together for good to them that are called and according to his purpose. So, including the news. Yes. The craziness. But God is telling us, you be faithful, stay with me. I'm going to watch out for you. There will be national disasters and local disasters, any kind of thing. God says, I care. Rebecca, in the back. Yes. Presumably, yes. And so think about Iran and Iraq. How do they solve problems today? Yeah, that's right. Boom, boom. Just blow each other up, hack each other up. Somebody comes in, take them in an embassy, dismember them, pass the body parts out to the family. Okay. And so I think back when here was Saddam Hussein, and he was told by Bush, look, you got to shape up. And well, he didn't want to look weak to his people. Why? Because what happens is you show any weakness out there, and everybody just brings out their forks and knives and hacks you up in little pieces and eats you. And so that's been the culture forever. That's how they subsist. But there's a God in heaven that is over all. What a joy to be together. Thank you for coming tonight and participating, because as we're studying Ruth, it's a little different than the women study it. It's here's the great attitudes for women. When we're talking about national this and that and harems and Pony Express and all the details, that's part of that life. Because now you're getting a fuller picture of the craziness that was going on and appears to be still going on. What a blessing to be together. Jim Hester, why don't you lead us in a closing prayer?